This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Peak oil. It isn't what you think, and it hasn't gone away. From Berlin, I'll interview Christian Kirschner about a new European-American university study on energy depletion. It will change our civilization. But what is Radio EcoShock all about? Find out as Janaya Donaldson of Peak Moment TV interviews me. And of course, I'll take my turn asking Janaya, why are we all living in the peak moment of human history? Has peak oil been blown away by shale tar sands and fracking? What industries are already in trouble with today's high oil prices? A joint study between the University of Maryland and a Barcelona university digs deep into our energy future. Our guest is Christian Kirschner. He's with the Institut de Ciencia y Tecnología.
It's the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology from the Autonomous University of Barcelona.
We've reached Christian in Berlin. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. Hi, Alex.
Well, first of all, what stimulated this joint university project called Economic Vulnerability to Peak Oil?
This research is part of, or the outcome of, my PhD research. I did a PhD in ecological economics, and from the very beginning on, this was motivated by concerns of supply restrictions of resources and limits to growth. And this is how I came across the topic of peak oil. And I realized that there was a great need of studying impacts and what this would mean for the economies.
I thought only alternative energy thinkers took peak oil seriously. Isn't it unusual for universities to study this?
Not at all anymore. I mean, this might have been the case for some time. I would say that peak oil in general is slowly entering a mainstream audience, only that they might use different wordings for it. For example, there's been also reports by the US and German armed forces, so already some time ago, about the phenomenon. There are now research projects funded by the state, for example, in Austria, and, in terms of adaptation and reducing the risks and so on.
And to be clear, you and your co-authors are not saying that oil is running out anytime soon, are you?
No, not at all. This is a great misunderstanding of the resource debate. Peak oil is not about running out. What we are running out is cheap oil. So we're not running out of oil, but of cheap oil and cheap energy. And in fact, if you want to say it like this, we will never really run out of oil. It's just that at some point, it's going to be so expensive that we're going to buy it only for certain applications and in small quantities. Like it is already the reality today in very poor countries where people buy petrol and kerosene in liter bottles.
And Christian Kirschner, although you are in Europe, your study picked the American economy as your model. Why is that?
There are many reasons for that. One is that the U.S. is the biggest consumer of oil. It's one of the largest or the largest economy of the world. And as a scientist, you also always have the restriction of data availability, which has to be taken into account. And there's very good data for the U.S. And although I'm European, the rest of the team that was involved in this project, they are now working in the U.S., as you know. So there were several reasons for this approach, of this choice of case study.
There's a very good graphic that accompanies your paper in the journal Global Environmental Change. It helped me to understand the paper. Could you try and describe the vulnerability map?
Yes. This is the key outcome that depicts what we found, and we chose the graph especially to make it visible what it means, what we found out, or what we tried to show. We have here a graph where you see bubbles, and the bubbles basically represent economic sectors. And the size of the bubbles represents their vulnerability to peak oil. For this, we used price increases. So if you have a price increase of oil in general in the U.S., how much would the prices of the outputs of those sectors or the products of those sectors increase according to the model we have used? This is the size of the bubble. Then you have the x-axis. On the x-axis, we show the importance of the sector in terms of contribution to GDP. And on the y-axis, we show importance in terms of structure. In terms of structure, this means that how important is this sector for all other sectors? How many relations does it have to other sectors? It might be an insignificant sector like plastics, for example, which doesn't bring a lot of income, but a lot of the other sectors depend on its output. So it's structurally important. And then you end up with this graph and you end up with different interpretations, of course, but the way we see it as one interpretation is that those sectors of the top right, which are very big, large circles, big bubbles, highly vulnerable, that they are a problem for the entire economy. Why? Because they are really important in terms of the structure and income. So we really need them. And at the same time, they are very vulnerable. So if prices increase, if we have scarcities, then those sectors could put the entire economy into trouble.
Well, getting to the findings, what sectors and industries are most vulnerable to peak oil?
Okay, I'm only going to mention a few examples. One of them would be the metals industry. Another very obvious one is transport industry, especially air transport. And then we have fertilizers and the petrochemical industry, which is also quite obvious.
I don't understand why the metals industry is included.
Well, the metal industry is one of the most energy-intensive sectors that we have. You need a lot of energy in order to produce the products of those sectors.
Okay. Well, can you go into more detail about the impacts of one particular industry exposed to higher oil prices or supply constraints?
Okay. If you take it like this, the inputs of a certain sector, let's take fertilizers, for example. Now, fertilizer industry is subject to higher oil prices. This means fertilizers become more expensive. The outputs of that sector are more expensive. This can lead to a shock wave of price increases down the supply chain of that sector. And since that sector will be very important and will have a large supply chain, it will affect the economy quite a lot and make a lot of the products that we need every day a lot more expensive. So for fertilizers, it would be food production. It does not mean, at the same time, that this sector will go bankrupt. On the contrary, it could have different results. That sector could still be very prosperous in a way. It depends on the substitution possibilities.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking peak oil from a new study done by universities in the United States and Europe. Our guest is Christian Kirchner, a specialist in ecological economics. I expect some investment firms will look closely at your findings. For example, a pension fund may not want to buy 30-year bonds in airlines or chemical plants. What can you tell us about that?
As I said already before, this is a complete wrong interpretation of our findings. In fact, it could mean the opposite. Not necessarily, of course, but it could mean that the fertilizer industry, for example, or take another industry, that it becomes it's very good for it because it's surviving in exchange of some other sectors which might disappear. It all depends on how possible it is to substitute the outputs of that sector and how essential that sector really is.
We generally, Christian, tend to think of fossil fuels becoming limited or at least more expensive because of resource constraints, but there are extreme weather events and fires attributed to climate change. Did your team consider a future bottleneck due to either carbon taxes or public boycotts of industries even damaging the atmosphere?
No, we did that. We did not do that in this time round, but our model allows an interpretation for such or an inclusion of such scenarios. And what's more, it can actually help to design carbon policies, for example. You can easily use the model to determine which of the sectors you want to phase out, for example, or which you want to protect, and others which you want to get rid of or which you don't want to have them so important for your economy.
In addition to peak oil and resource scarcity, you personally have also studied and published about steady state economics. And again, I may have a misunderstanding here, but I thought that an economy which survives on its own carbon use would have to be much smaller. What do you say to that?
I agree. This is why I also talk about degrowth as a necessary, degrowth in a socially benign way, a process to reduce our energy and material throughput in the rich countries, to bring them to a level that is sustainable globally.
We've had some degrowth conferences, so there is a lot of discussion about that. I want to get back to your study, Economic Vulnerability to Peak Oil. I was intrigued by the concept that energy flows may be limited simply by available technology, if I understood it. Does that imply no matter how much money we throw at developing fossil fuels, we may hit a ceiling, a point where the return on investment is just too low to continue?
Yes, of course. That's absolutely right. Below a certain ratio of energy input versus energy output, a resource becomes or fails to be a primary energy resource. Once you get less energy out than you put in the first place, you will not use that resource anymore, no matter how high the price is. It's not going to be an energy resource. You might use that product like oil for other applications, more higher priced applications, but not as a primary energy resource. Technology can, of course, improve that ratio. There's a nice example of peak oil is sometimes described also as this fruit tree, where we've already eaten most of the very low-hanging fruits, and we need to get higher and higher up to get the really good fruits. And this is a very tall tree. So at some point, if you imagine it very tall, the ladder has to be so high, and it takes so much time and effort to climb up that it's not worth it anymore.
What do you hope for this new study? What does your team expect it will do?
Well, what we want to do is, first of all, we want to emphasize the research that has been done that pointed the proximity of the phenomenon and the dangers, so that it is taken serious. And then we want to go beyond, or we would like to see a process that takes us beyond the discussion of peak oil yes or peak oil no, because there's many reasons for why we should initiate a process towards a post-carbon economy. There is also climate change, for example, and resource limits per se. They can be positive, because they give us the push in the right direction. So whereas a lot of people see peak oil as doom mongering, and say this is pessimism, I often say that I feel quite optimistic about it, because it gives us opportunities to look in different directions.
Well, Christian Kirschner, you've picked a specialty which is real, it's important, and it's not very popular with the fossil fuel and mining industries right now. Do you feel resistance to people talking about resource limits?
Yes, one could say so. It's not the same with all oil companies, for example. There are some oil companies which do acknowledge peak oil, and some of them, I would say, there are not very many, but then the next question or next problem is, of course, what is the policy recommendation? And one not very desirable, in my opinion, is then that we need to drill more in order to make sure that we don't reach peak oil so fast.
And do you sense that there is a growing interest in peak oil and resource depletion in, say, the public or in governments?
In general, I would say yes. Again, I would say that the term peak oil is avoided in many of those debates. In the U.S., because of the shale oil developments, or the shale gas developments, much better, there has been now this boom and this idea that peak oil is dead in a way. And many arguments why we don't agree with such a judgment, which I don't want to go into now. But in sustainability sciences, it's very much already an accepted fact. And also, there is already studies funded by national research bodies in order to look at, to make us more resilient and so on.
Well, listeners, I think this joint university work, Bridging the Atlantic, is a milestone for the study of peak oil and resources generally. You can find a link to the informative press release, plus the paper abstract, at least complete with the all-important graphs, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest is Christian Kirschner, and he's from Europe, but he's working with the University of Maryland team as well. Thank you, Christian, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith. You're about to hear a preview of my appearance on Peak Moment TV. The video will play on Community Access TV in the United States and other countries, and on YouTube later this month.
This is Peak Moment. We are living at a peak of human innovation, information, wealth, and health. But we're also at a peak of population and consumption, with rising temperatures and declining resources fueled by cheap oil and gas. Peak Moment Television, bringing you examples of positive responses to energy decline and climate change through local community action.
Hi, welcome to Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson. I'm in Vancouver, BC, and I'm with somebody who's also in the media, Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. Alex, give us a sense of what kinds of topics you try to cover in EcoShock and what you're trying to have people learn from your guests.
Well, it started out as an environmental show, but we also cover peak oil and energy issues. And occasionally we've touched on the economy if we think it's going to hit people directly. In the environment angle, we've mostly been covering two items, which is climate change, a lot on climate change. I think it's the number one issue that's going to face our generation and all the coming generations.
Yes.
And then we have also covered Fukushima quite a bit because partly we live on the West Coast and we got doused with some radiation here, but also it's another thing that's going to keep going for as long as you and I are alive, really.
And we'll be on. Thank you. Because those two, I turn to Radio EcoShock, what you're doing, because it feels to me that you are fearlessly putting out the data, the information. I mean, I certainly don't trust the mainstream. There's been so much climate denial in America, of course, paid for by corporate interests, that it feels like it's only just now poking its head up here and there in a way that's still not telling the whole story.
Well, it's just amazing to me, Janaya, that the people who are getting burned out of their homes or who are experiencing extreme floods or tornadoes or blowing them away tend to be the people who are voting in legislators, whether congressmen or senators, who are denying that climate change exists. It's the last desperate moment, I think, before the big realization sweeps across America. And that same battle is happening in other countries. It's happening in Australia and the UK. Europe, of course, greatly is ahead of us as far as realizing what's going on with climate change. But I'm hoping pretty soon that people in Texas that are sweating it out, and that if the air conditioning isn't working in Oklahoma, you can't go outside, you get fires coming earlier and earlier and staying later and later.
Yes.
I'm hoping all of those people will listen to what their own scientists are saying. And I do interview the scientists, and they have no doubt about what's going on.
Would you paint a picture for us of what, you know, you've learned so much through your guests. Can you sort of paint a picture for what is most likely unfolding?
Well, we had an understanding, we thought, of when climate change would begin to arrive. Mm-hmm. And we got that from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a group of scientists who have to report to governments, I might add, on what they say. And it looked like people were talking about 2040, 2050. We'd see the first really big hits. But the scientists that I talk to now have brought that way forward and say, no, it's happening now.
Yes.
We're getting it right now. We're seeing some sea level rise now. We're seeing storm surges like in Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. We're seeing the Arctic melt, which just blew everyone's mind, frankly. No one had expected that to happen.
Really?
There were no predictions for that.
Really?
No.
Actually, somebody just said to me that the IPCC panel did not include polar ice melt as in their original prognostications.
No, they didn't even include it in their last report. They said, well, the science is too uncertain, so we don't know. But they had been talking about ice melt in the Arctic around 2075. So quite a bit
out. We're way ahead of time.
We're way ahead of time on that. And that is the one that really woke up people around the world, I think, especially people who are paying attention, that we have greatly altered the climate of the Earth already. The permafrost is starting to melt. We're at risk of this chemical called methane becoming a gas in the atmosphere.
Methane, let's go back on this. The methane hydrates, tell us a little bit about the science of that.
Well, there's two kinds of methane, really, that we have to be concerned about. Methane hydrates are at the bottom of the sea. They're a frozen, icy slush ball of methane. And they're called clathrates. That's the technical term. Now, they show some signs of melting off the low seabed near Siberia, in eastern Siberia. But it's not so serious that we're seeing extra methane in the atmosphere yet that we all have to panic. The other large source of methane is happening right where the tundra is, right melted from ages past. There were plant materials. The last time we had climate change, the last time we had global warming, there were alligators and crocodiles up around in the Arctic Ocean.
So it was that warm. And we'll get that warm again if we continue the way we're going. All this plant material is just there waiting to melt. And when it does melt, if it's underwater, like ponds and rivers, it releases methane. If it's dry, it releases carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And methane's
mm-hmm.
just such a dangerous gas because it's at least 12 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And that's on the 100-year time scale. But what we care about is what's happening on a 10-year or 20-year time
yes.
scale. And there it's 75 times more powerful. So we could get a jolt. We could get a big burst of warming. And some scientists believe, the ones that I talk to, the only reason we haven't seen it so far is because of an ocean cooling event happening now in the Pacific. And that's just a rhythmic event that happens from time to time. It's La Nina
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
happening instead mm-hmm. of El Nino.
Mm-hmm.
When it switches back to El Nino, which it will, we may see a great deal of warming, and that means the kind of weather you would expect.
Which is?
You see more violent storms come when you have a hurricane. You may not have more hurricanes, but when you have a hurricane, it picks up heat right off the ocean and picks up extra moisture. And so you get these giant dumps of rainfall and extreme winds, as you had in Hurricane Sandy. That's exactly what happened there. That's exactly what happened with Hurricane Katrina.
I was going to say Katrina.
Other big example.
Got right into our faces with that, and the denial kept going on even after that.
It did, and parts of New Orleans have never been rebuilt
mm-hmm.
and never should be rebuilt because you won't be able to hold on to them. But the thing that most people will experience is just that we just had a period here in Vancouver and in the West Coast where it was almost summer weather, even though it's the end of October. Well, that's the kind of change-up you can expect. And you'll see earlier springs, and you'll have longer periods, especially in the American South, or in Australia, where you get over 100 degrees for 3 months straight.
Mm.
It'll
wow.
just be
wow.
uncomfortable. Stinking hot.
Stinking hot. Well, we visited with friends who said, we already know that summer is arriving a couple weeks earlier, sting a couple weeks later. It looks like even this summer, what you're talking about, even further than a couple weeks later, and that they already consider themselves to be in a warmer zone plant-wise. For planting, you know, when's the frost-free season, than they were even a few years ago, that it's already shifting the planting timeframes.
Well, they're right. I mean, the official agency that declares plant hardiness zones in the United States, for example, has already moved the zones further north. But the plants and animals know this too, and they're already moving towards the poles, and so are the fishes in the sea. So that we're seeing fish here that used to be in Northern California.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're going to see more of that.
How extreme do you think it may get? What are you hearing from the scientists in let's say, the next 20, 30 years?
I wish we knew.
Yeah.
We're running a great big experiment on planet Earth. I would say the majority of the scientists of the world feel that it will proceed fairly slowly. And then there are perhaps 20% of the scientists, and some of them are at the top of their field. We'll include James Hansen of the United States, for example, or my recent guest, Dr. Peter Ward. There are many scientists who feel that we could experience a jump in temperatures, as I said before, in which case we'll see more extreme events earlier. We don't know the timetable. What we do know is it won't stop even now. Even if we stop using fossil fuels, we will have some climate change. But it will become much worse if we don't stop using fossil fuels.
And does anybody have any optimism about that happening? I mean, that's a very negative way to say it, a pessimistic way of saying it. But so far, I've just seen a lot of, well, the United States is a grand example of foot dragging.
Well, I wouldn't go that far because actually the United States has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions since about 2008. Now, part of that was due to the economy.
Sure.
There was less industry putting out pollution, and industry is a major source of pollution. But also, Americans started buying more fuel-efficient cars, which was a major breakthrough. Detroit in the George Bush years said, oh, we can't get to 22 miles to gallon. We just can't do it. And now they're putting out cars that get 45 miles to gallon, and people are buying them.
Right.
So that's a major change up. And there are other reasons that it's happening. People are driving less. So I can see that even if people don't believe in climate change, just for economic reasons, with the higher price of oil, they're making some better decisions in some countries. Unfortunately, we're losing all of those benefits because China is wanting to become industrialized too, and their coal burning is so extreme it's overcome any advantage that the United States reductions might have had.
So, and again, we're not at the level of international concern and agreements, I mean, because China wants to move up in the world, if you will.
No, our emissions are increasing. There's no question about it. They're increasing at about 2% per year. Last year it was about 3% per year. And that 1% is a gigantic amount of carbon gone into the atmosphere. So we're chugging away towards a climate catastrophe, really. And I'm not just making that up. That's what the scientists that we talk to are saying. Whether we can avoid it or not will depend on a mass change in consciousness around the world. And when that will come or whether it will come in time is something we don't know yet.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, there are a lot of vested interests probably wanting to keep the status quo because of the economic system, you know, and the economic benefits for that until it begins to hurt, I suppose.
Yes. Unfortunately, the main drivers of our economy right now, I would say, is gas and oil, especially here in British Columbia, for example, where they want to build liquid natural gas production facilities and just got elected by saying we're going to produce a lot more of it. And we have the tar sands in Alberta. The United States has shale oil and so on, and fracking.
Fracking
is very inefficient. It's as bad as coal by the time you go all the way down the supply chain for natural gas. Yes,
fracking, which is you know the horizontal drilling for natural gas. And my understanding is that it's polluting wells. It's creating a horrible mess.
Yes, and from a greenhouse perspective, it's just awful. After they get the well drilled, they leave it open for a couple of weeks, and they either flare it, which is just putting more carbon in the atmosphere, or they let it all go into the atmosphere, which puts plus toxic chemicals and a lot of methane and a lot of dirty materials. They can't cap it until it gets cleaner, and then they can use it.
Oh, wow.
But all down the pipeline system, the pipelines leak, the storage systems that they use emit more methane, and then they have to put them into older city distribution systems, which you can go around with a truck and measure the methane from them, and you get huge spikes coming out all over the place where our cities are actually leaking methane. You can make a map and a visual of what they look like. So natural gas, I'm sorry, it's just as bad as coal, and it's not going to work as a bridge fuel. It's a bridge to nowhere.
Well, it's a bridge to worse climate emissions, more greenhouse gases.
Right. More storms, more rising seas. My recent guest, Peter Ward, says rising seas is the number one thing to worry about with climate change. South Florida, for example, will no longer be on the map by 2100 to 2150 just because of the glaciers that are melting in Greenland and to some degree in Antarctica. They put so much extra water in the sea and the seas expand when they're heated. And South Florida, the highest point is about 12 feet off the ocean. Miami is already getting a lot of flooding in the streets, and that's just the start of it. So within the next 10 or 20 years, some people will be rethinking their investments in Miami real estate, period.
I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. You're listening to my own appearance on Peak Moment TV with Janiyah Donaldson. I'm summarizing what I've learned from the scientists, authors, and activists you've heard over the past 7 years on Radio EcoShock. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more.